Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Parents have many concerns when it comes to protecting their children and keeping them safe. And in recent years, a new concern has surfaced. Children are facing growing risks of grooming, manipulation, even sextortion in online spaces as predators use coercion, deception, and now artificial intelligence to create false personas. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children logged more than 546,000 reports of online enticement last year. That's a 192% increase over 2023. And the use of artificial intelligence is up 1,325%. And this practice has moved beyond chat rooms to social media, gaming platforms, even encrypted apps that target kids. To fight this, it is now state law that all school districts show age-appropriate anti-grooming educational videos in the early days of the school year. Here's a snippet of one of those videos aimed at high schoolers.
Offenders often target people they feel are vulnerable because of issues or challenges in their personal lives. They take advantage of their power to create unequal relationships. If unreported, many individuals offend multiple times before they're caught. Knowing the signs of abuse is the first step in preventing it.
But what should parents be looking for? What proactive steps can they take to protect their children from online grooming and predation? This hour we hear from a survivor. Harrison Haynes is the founder of DIM, a collective movement that believes in a better, safer digital future. He is also chair of the End Online Sexual Exploitation and Abuse of Children Coalition, which specializes in survivor-centered and trauma-informed legislation. He's a student at James Madison University studying social work. He joins us with Kevin Roughton, special agent in charge at North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation. He's also the head of the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. And Ashley Shanley is district attorney for Cabarrus County with a 20-plus year level of experience in prosecuting special victims' crimes. Good morning to you all. I'm going to start with Harrison because he has to go to class at 9:30, so I'm going to lose him early in the program. You are a survivor, as I said, who was groomed by an online predator at the age of 12, which makes it about 10 years ago or so. And you were groomed while playing, I understand, video games. We'll hear your story in a second. And for years, parents have always been afraid of children being tampered with at the mall or picked up by somebody in a white van going down the street. But now they felt safe having their kids in the home. But now this stuff is happening in the home, in a place that's considered safe. What exactly happened to you, Harrison?
Yeah, Mike, I couldn't agree more. The call is coming from inside our homes now. They're not coming from the white vans anymore. When I was 12 years old, I was transitioning to middle school. I was a lonely and isolated preteen, going through preteen things like all of us did. I had a hard time making friends. So I looked to the only place that I really felt like I could belong, in online spaces. I could hide behind an avatar. I could feel confident. I could feel more myself than I could in person. And so I made a friend on online gaming.
So this was 10 years ago when this activity probably wasn't as ubiquitous or prevalent as it is today, and likely less sophisticated than it is today. How has it changed since this happened to you, since you follow this as part of your extracurricular life?
Absolutely. That's a great question. Well, for me, it was very simple in the beginning. I met a friend, and for 6 months or more, our friendship was very normal. It was almost healthy. In a way, he was like a mentor or a brother. In some ways, he was like a therapist. Now it feels like young people, kids are being sextorted, and now AI is involved. For us, it was just one-to-one human connection and manipulation and perversion. But now it's just so much more.
Who did you think he was when he struck up this online alleged friendship with you? Who did you think he was? How did he present himself?
He presented himself as a fun, caring individual that was going to be there for me when I needed it. It was very casual. It was very organic. He was a 19-year-old boy from Connecticut.
And was he?
Connecticut, no, New Jersey, even closer to me. But yes, he was actually the age that he said he was. And that's the craziest thing is it's not, 50-year-olds in their mom's basement like everyone thinks. It's another kid. And the internet doesn't just create victims, it also forges predators too, and typically in cycles of harm.
And I know that there are going to be people who are very familiar with gaming platforms and how gaming with other people who are could be anywhere in the world works. But there are also people listening to us today who have no clue about how this works or that this even exists. So talk to me about this gaming platform. You're playing a game and you're playing with other people who could be anywhere, and anyone. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right.
Were your parents aware of the dangers involved in that kind of activity when you're playing, probably in your bedroom alone?
Yeah, we had our consoles in our gaming rooms, and we had like a little gaming room, or we had the consoles in our bedroom. And I don't think that any of us were really aware of the harms. For so many of us, video games at the time were a community building exercise. It was a time to get away, to take a load off and to connect with people, maybe in a meaningful way. So I don't think really any of us were aware at the time.
So this it happened to you on a gaming platform. Could it just as easily have happened on some other platform?
Absolutely. I think platforms like Instagram or Facebook have the same capacity to facilitate online harm, such as Discord or Reddit as well.
You've been pretty critical from the things that I've read that you have said in the past about all these platforms, and we'll talk about that. But in your opinion, which are the riskier platforms, if that's even a question that can be answered.
Well, I think it's hard because, and we'll probably talk about it later, but the policy precedent that brought us where we are, all platforms are kind of in a weird space where they're protected from litigation for online harm, and users really aren't held super liable for what's happening. So I don't really think either of them are more safe than the other.
You never met, correct me if I'm wrong, but you never met the person that you interacted with online. Is that correct?
No, virtually, yes, but in person, never.
Did they want to meet you?
Yes.
And we're talking about grooming young people, grooming teenagers. Without getting too explicit, what are they grooming you for?
There is a lot of different things that someone might be interested in. For my abuser specifically, our friendship was very casual at first. It was, like I said, a mentorship. And so, he was supporting me for a long time, and it slowly started looking like he was interested in photographs or videos. And at the very end, he wanted to see pictures and videos of me self-harming myself.
Self-harming yourself.
That's right.
He presented himself as a 19-year-old, and in fact turned out to be a 19-year-old. You were what, 12 years old at
Yeah,
the
12,
time?
13. Yeah.
Did it ever occur to you, did it ever make you wonder why a 19-year-old would strike up this first at first casual relationship and then take it into something else? Surely you were looking at him as a mentor. What did it ever occur to you that why would he be interested in you?
I wish I could have asked myself the same question from right now. I think I was so vulnerable and in such a place of hurt that I would have skipped out on that question every time you'd ask. I really don't know. And there were times where I thought that it wasn't an appropriate friendship, but I also realized that I was between a rock and a hard place, between having no friends and having a friend who had the potential to hurt me. So it was worth the risk.
You described yourself as lonely. You didn't have any friends. You were hurt. This person took an interest in you, became a kind of mentor to you. And that may sound odd to some people, but I'll bet you, and you can probably tell me because you have a lot of friends your age. How uncommon is that? How common or uncommon is that for young people to feel that way and to gravitate toward people they would meet in these situations because It's safe and they're friendly.
In a world of more social pressure and social perfectionism, I think it's more potent than ever for people to feel ashamed for going through things. So I think people look online to speak into the void and talk to a stranger about the things they're going through. In a way, it's very much like therapy. So I would imagine so many people in my age group were experiencing this at the time.
Again, you were 12 years old at the time this was happening, and you weren't making friends, and this was happening in a gaming space. You found it to be a space of solace for you. And the fact that this 19-year-old was talking to you and acting as a mentor and becoming your confidant, and you were allowing you to tell him things, or enabling you to tell him things that you didn't feel safe sharing with anybody else, I guess, including your parents. And you say that as you became more comfortable with this person, they urged you to move your conversation away from this gaming platform to texting. I believe I'm correct in saying he wanted you to move at the time, this is a long time ago, to Apple's iMessage app. Is that true?
That's correct.
Why?
Well, at the time, we were using a messaging platform called Xbox. We had an Xbox app. We could exchange things on our username. Part of his username had his personal information, and it had reporting features. iMessage, however, was end-to-end encrypted and did not have any reporting features available. He was, as far as he wanted to be for his iCloud email, completely anonymous.
You mentioned that one of the things that this moved toward over time was he wanted to see pictures of you indulging in self-harm. Did you do that?
I did not. Fortunately, he started to try to coerce me. He had supported me for a long time through different things I was going through, making friends at school, struggling with geometry homework. He even helped me do my homework. And he started to experience his own mental health harms and mental health struggles. And so that's kind of when that behavior started. Unfortunately, I never indulged.
So this went on for what, about a year? This relationship online?
Yeah, this friendship was about a year and a half.
What made it stop?
Well, it came to a climax point where I just couldn't keep going.
And I keep referring to him as a he. It was, in fact, a man or a young
That's right.
man, correct?
Yes.
Is that, are the, since you run these other organizations, do you find that most of the perpetrators are male?
Well, typically, yes. But I don't know if it's always helpful, because that creates blind spots.
How harmful, in retrospect, do you think this experience was for you?
Well, unfortunately, my abuser took advantage of my my questions about sexuality. I had this girl that I really liked, and I wanted to be somebody for her, but I wasn't attracted to her that way, and I really wanted to be. So I started watching pornography by his recommendation to fix my broken sense of sexuality. I used pornography to try to fix myself for a really long time, even after he was gone, only to realize that I wasn't the problem. So I navigated that difficult relationship with pornography, and as well as the self-harm that I started trying when he was gone. So it really took a toll on me.
Wow. I want to talk about your parents' reaction to this when you finally told them, because I know you talked about how you kept this person secret from them for a very long time. And a lot of that is true with a lot of young people. They don't want to tell their parents they're involved in something like this. And they don't even want to tell the parents some of the things that they're telling their perpetrators. But your parents' reaction to this was commendable, from what I understand. And we'll talk about that when we come back with Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about grooming, online grooming this morning, which is a phenomenon that has grown in intensity over the years. And in North Carolina, at least, all schools at the very beginning of the school year now have to show age-appropriate videos to children to alert them to the dangers of online grooming and how it occurs and give them some tools in their toolkit to avoid this behavior. Harrison Haynes didn't have the benefit of that because what happened to him happened 10 years ago when he was 12. He's now at James Madison University. He's also the founder of DIM, Digitally Intentional Movement, and also the chairman of OSEAC, which is a survivors organization for people who are victims of this crime. We'll be talking to somebody from the State Bureau of Investigation and a district attorney about all this in just a moment. We lose Harrison at 9:30 because he has to go to class. You kept your interactions with this individual secret from your parents. You didn't tell them. And I would imagine at first, why would you? It was just a conversation you were having in a gaming platform. But then suddenly, over time, things began to change. That relationship began to change, and you still kept it secret. Why?
He exposed me to pornography that at 12 years old, I was very interested in, and I had never been exposed before. So that feeling of shame really covered our friendship and kept it secret. It was like he leveraged it against me.
And when how did your parents find out?
It was the culmination of several nights in a row. He kept calling me in the middle of the night and threatening to take his life if I didn't show him pictures and videos of my body, which I had never done. I was growing sick of it because he had supported me and I had supported him through so much. It felt like our friendship was falling apart and I realized I was being coerced and manipulated. I couldn't help but get mad, cry, yell. And so my parents woke up and they took my phone that night and discovered everything.
And when they discovered it, what kind of this is scary for any kid, it would seem to me. So what kind of a conversation did they have with you? What was their reaction to that?
Well, I hardly slept that night because I wasn't sure if he had taken his life. But the next morning, I discovered he hadn't. I was very relieved. And they brought me downstairs. We talked about pornography. We talked about how I was manipulated, how this person was lying to me, how he wasn't actually hurting. It was a terrifying experience, and I just wanted to stay in bed that morning.
What advice do you have for children who may find themselves in a similar situation? Unless they are listening at night or to our podcast version of this program, they're not going to hear this because they're all in class. But what advice would you have?
Well, I don't know if I would give the children advice, actually. I think I might put advice onto the parents. And it's very important for parents to create a very open, very safe and nurturing environment. And I love my parents to death, but I felt like our relationship was very authority-based. And if parents like mine in my community, like they all are, they wanted to protect me. They wanted to safeguard me. But what I really needed was a safe place to fall if I had made a mistake. And luckily my parents really learned from that, and we all did. So I would say conversations early and often about hard things to create that safe space.
Following this experience, as I understand it, you ended up using a flip phone for a while. Was that at your parents' insistence? Is that a good idea? Do you think that that is what all children of a certain age should be using in terms of communication devices, a flip phone and not a smartphone?
Well, people ask me to share my story, and I think my whole life has been a narrative of digital harm. I actually didn't get rid of my smartphone until I went to college. And it's been 3.5 years now that I've used a flip phone.
Oh, you do now?
Yes, I do.
Why?
I love it. I've been off social media. The algorithm has influenced me in ways that are unhelpful. And I feel like genuine connection starts face to face.
Yeah. When you became older, you say that you became angry that the iMessaging platform, which is an Apple feature, did not have any features at the time that this was going on to keep you safe. There's no way to report a perpetrator, and you blame the operators of these platforms, not just Apple, but others, for making the tools of abuse so accessible. Has that situation changed over the last decade?
Well, I think that change is a direction, and we're certainly going in the right direction. My job is not just to simply critique technology, but to reimagine technology to enhance our lives. Unfortunately, so many messaging platforms like iMessage are facilitating harm even between family members. That's where the real harm is happening. And we've seen different initiatives, like in Australia, these reporting features are under beta testing. So we're going in the right direction.
At one point, you said that these platforms are not safe for children, and if we can't make them safe, perhaps children shouldn't be on them at all. Do you still feel that way?
I do still feel that way. I think corporate greed and negligence has brought us to a place where one of their largest markets are young people, retaining their attention and giving them harm through algorithmically curated material. It's just not a safe place for them to exist right now.
So you have these two organizations that you are involved in, DIM, a digital intentional movement. It's a collective movement that believes in the better, safer digital future. You also are the chair of the End Online Sexual Exploitation and Abuse of Children Coalition, which specializes in survivor-centered and trauma-informed legislation. And you say, when you say to operators that they need to clean up their act or not be accessible to children on this platform, or if you say that to lawmakers, what reaction do you get?
I think a lot of folks are really excited because I think so many people want to be on the right side of history. And we went to Meta's headquarters in New York City, and we had one message. It wasn't that we're angry. We want to co-create a better future with you. We don't want to ruin your reputation. We want to make this better. We want to make this work.
And their reaction? Are they cooperating?
Often excited.
Are they cooperating? Are you seeing changes?
Well, is it in their corporate interest to reduce their market size? Probably not. So will they do it? Probably not.
Mm. Harrison Haynes is the founder of DIM, the chairman of OSEAC Survivors Council, and a student at James Madison University. I know you have to go to class, so I'm going to let you go. Thank you for joining us this morning and sharing your story with us. We appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Mike. Bye, guys.
You're welcome. Also with us is Kevin Routon. He's special agent in charge at North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation. He's the head of the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force in North Carolina. And Ashley Shanley is district attorney for Cabarrus County. She has 20 years experience in prosecuting special victims crimes like this. I want to ask both of you the same question. And Ashley, I'll begin with you. How common is Harrison's experience?
The factors that Harrison just described echo so many of the cases I worked with. I've sat across the table I'm sitting at from heartbroken parents and heartbroken students. The factors that you meet someone online, that they start on a site that maybe is known to us, and then quickly the offender will want you to move to a site that's not monitored or regulated, and that parents are the last to know. We see that a lot. And so when I became the district attorney, I decided, hey, we've got to stop these cases from ever reaching our desk. So we've been speaking with student groups, parents, youth groups, athletic leagues, whoever will have us, and shows like yours to give parents some tips. So maybe this victimization can stop and parents can know what's going on. But I do want to leave just this. Sometimes when I speak with parents, they're worried. There's so many things they have to look out for their children. They're thinking, is this just one more? I think we can't underestimate the value of good supervision and common sense. And watching what your children are doing. You mentioned, should children have these phones and apps? Certainly not without supervision. So yes, we're seeing this, we're seeing tons of these cases, and it's our goal to make this stop.
Kevin, same question. I mean, his case was, and we'll talk about this, how his case seemingly was unprosecutable, but certainly I suppose it could be investigated. How common is his story?
His story is significantly more common today than it was when it happened to him. There are more platforms today. There's more devices today. There is more opportunity today. It is extremely more common. Looking at statistics, looking at numbers, all of it will tell us it's more common. And it will tell us that the age at which victimization may occur is becoming younger and younger because we're putting devices in kids' hands at a younger and younger age. Kids are on the internet at a younger and younger age. And it's not necessarily that the internet is evil or that social media is evil or gaming is evil. It's all in how we use it. And to echo Ashley's comments there about supervision is required. Absolutely. We have to teach kids how to use it properly, not just hand them a device and walk away.
And the FBI, Kevin, recommends that parents make sure that their kids use privacy settings online and educate themselves about games and apps and websites that their kids are visiting online. You've just echoed all of that. So the state of North Carolina's Bureau of Investigation would be on the same page with the FBI, correct?
From that aspect, absolutely. We totally would want privacy settings and parental notifications and safeguards for kids. But I also don't want a parent to feel like they've checked the blocks on that and not have a conversation with their child. Far too often, they feel like they've done something, but they really didn't do the hard thing that sometimes matters the most, and that's engaging with their kid and having a conversation about these dangers.
When Harrison's family filed a report with local police, Ashley, this was 10 years ago, the local police told the family the case was not prosecutable due to a lack of evidence and limited cooperation from the family. I'm not sure what that last part means, but I know you can't comment on that particular case. But how do parents build a prosecutable case against this sort of activity once they find out that it is occurring? What kind of evidence is helpful for you that they have to collect?
I did not hear what state Harrison was in when that crime occurred, but each state has different laws. And right. North Carolina has a law, solicitation of a minor to engage in sexual acts. And all that is required is that an adult entice or advise a minor to meet with an adult for an unlawful sex act. So when I was listening to Harrison's story, he was saying there at the end, you asked him, did he want to meet with you? And he said, yes, he did. I think if it was explicit what he wanted to meet Harrison for, we would have a crime here in North Carolina.
How would you prove it? He wants to meet. That doesn't mean he wants to do anything nefarious. He presented himself as a mentor. So how would that be evidence in a prosecutable crime?
You would look at the conversations between the two, and yes, you're correct. They would have to be explicit in what he wanted to do. And what is so sad today, Mike, is that these offenders will get online with a child, and we can just watch the text. Within 6 minutes, these offenders are talking about the sex acts they want to do with those children. I'm sure Kevin has been a part of a number of ops, and he can tell you down to the minute. But our local sheriff's office was telling me as they were doing an op last year, it was the soonest one they had was within 2 minutes of conversation, the offender saying, child, I'd like to do A, B, and C with you.
So, Kevin, how does law enforcement track when you become aware of this? If a parent calls you or an individual who is engaging in this activity feels troubled by it and is savvy enough to call law enforcement, can you track it successfully? Can you use metadata on a phone or a computer to figure out who's on the other end of this?
The internet is not anonymous. As many people would like to believe, we can do things in anonymity on the internet. And to some extent, that's true. But the reality is the internet, in the mere way it functions, most of the time does provide a trail. So it depends on a lot of things on how we can follow that trail, as far as what platforms were used, what companies are involved. There's a lot of different factors. But for the most part, I will tell you that things that happen on the internet are not in an anonymous fashion. There are investigatable things that we can follow.
It's clear that the platforms involved in all this, Kevin, don't feel that they have any responsibility, but do they, and are they at risk?
Are the platforms at risk?
Yes. And if you decide to go after the perpetrators and they've been using these platforms, perhaps not just with one mark, but with several, are the platforms, can they be held responsible?
I think that's a highly difficult thing to do at this point. Harming their reputation may be what they're most concerned about. If their platform becomes known for this type of thing, then that could be damaging to their business model, which honestly, that may be the most threatening thing that we have against them.
What are the barriers, Ashley, to a successful prosecution of a crime like this? What gets in your way?
Certainly having a cooperative victim, but we have found as more people understand the prevalence of this, I rarely have a family that doesn't want to proceed. The other piece may be a jurisdictional question, but in North Carolina, you can prosecute, for instance, with Harrison's case, where the offender was when he made those comments or where Harrison was when he received them. And so for North Carolina, I can prosecute if in Cabarrus County, someone was out of state and was soliciting the child, I could prosecute here because the child was here. As far as any other barriers, it used to be what you mentioned before. Did the offender get close enough with the subject matter to show what their intentions were? Not anymore. Now it's explicit. The language is explicit. They don't even use code words. So that's certainly not a barrier for us.
Under U.S. law, tech firms, as I understand it, Kevin, are now obliged to flag suspicious material that they find on their sites and notify the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Snapchat is said to have reported 20,000 incidences of concerning material, including sextortion and child sexual abuse images, in the first half of last year. How do they uncover this evidence, and what is done with it once the platforms report it?
Yeah, it has been a matter of federal law for quite some time that if a platform becomes aware of explicit content involving minors on their platform, they are required to report it to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. What has changed recently, though, is the teeth behind that to force them to report, and also a mandate for them to maintain that evidence. Previously, they just had to report it, but then when law enforcement began to investigate, if they didn't have the records, it became very difficult. And so new legislation has required them to not only file that report, but maintain the evidence that substantiates that potential crime for a year so that law enforcement can do a thorough investigation in that.
According to The Guardian, which I believe is a British publication, the 20,000 instances of concerning material on Snapchat eclipses the number reported on platforms like Facebook and Instagram and TikTok and X and Google and a platform that I'm not familiar with called Discord. But they also say that Snapchat revised its policies this year so that subsequent figures may show a decline. I want to talk about that when we come back, and also what AI is doing to this whole milieu of perpetrators targeting young people for various reasons. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte, aiming to inspire high school students through an international curriculum and IB diploma program, preparing them for college, careers, and a global community. More at bischarlotte.org.
Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about digital crimes. We're talking about crimes targeting young people that happen on digital platforms with Kevin Routon, special agent in charge at North Carolina's State Bureau of Investigation, head of the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, and Ashley Shanley, district attorney for Cabarrus County. I mentioned that various platforms have been keeping track of these perpetrators and these crimes, but Snapchat revised its policies this year so that subsequent reporting of figures may show a decline. I'm not sure what the question is there, Ashley, but it's concerning to me that they would revise their policies so that they show less of a problem when, in fact, the problem is probably stasis or increasing. Are the laws governing these platforms strong enough?
No, they're not. I think there are rules about how old you can be to be on some of these platforms, but we all know they're not followed. I will say that our local law enforcement really take turns.
Let me stop you right there. Let me ask you a question about that, because when it comes to pornography in North Carolina, you have to prove that you are 18 in order to get on most of these sites. They put up a block. Why don't they do that on these platforms for kids?
I think there would be some monitoring requirements. I'm sure that would be difficult with the number of users that they have. But I think, Mike,
pornography is the most watched stuff on the internet by all reports that I've read. So they've done it. Why can't these platforms do it?
I think that's excellent questions for the platforms. But I think Kevin and I have to deal with the aftermath of the victims here. We don't have maybe authority to do that. But what I do have authority to do is to go out there and educate our citizens and then prosecute those who don't follow the law.
Kevin, you want to chime in on that?
Yeah, I think certainly the technology exists, right? To your point, there have been limitations that have been put in place on specific platforms and yet not enacted and enabled on others. Clearly, the technology is there. I would go back to, it seems it may be a harmful impact to their business model, let's just say, to enact that in other places. But clearly, technology is there. And would it protect more kids if we don't have them on these platforms? Absolutely.
And we're talking about crimes that often result in horrific tragedies. It's an international problem, and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children has resulted in more than three dozen teenage boys taking their own lives, falling victim to sextortion since 2021. Are boys actually more susceptible to this than young women?
I think I have both, but what I will say about the suicidal ideation, our local pediatrician talked about that became a screening tool for any, especially young male, who had suicidal ideation. They do a sexual assault screening. I'm not saying that they all have been sexually assaulted, but it's a high risk. So it seems that both females and males are being privy to this type of abuse, but it seems our males are taking it to the self-harm level, like Harrison was encouraged to do.
So how common is sextortion, Kevin? Is this the most frequent or the most serious or the most common type of crime in this category that we've been talking about this morning? And are the perpetrators usually strangers, or are they friends at school who use this to settle disagreements?
Well, I'll answer your last question first, and that answer is yes. It's both. It is people that they know that are trying to settle something, but also it can fully be someone that they don't know at all. As far as the most prevalent part, currently it is not. Based on National Center for Missing and Exploited Children statistics and cyber tips that we receive from them, there is still a child exploitation imagery that has higher numbers. However, what I will tell you is in the last few years, it has been astronomical increases in the online solicitation and specifically in sextortion. We have seen that grow dramatically in the last few years. And Ashley, you mentioned males versus females a moment ago. We've always seen this sextortion piece. Historically, the females were more victimized in this way because the perpetrator was going after more content. So they would find a female victim, most of the stereotypically, and then they would try to get them to produce more content. What we've seen in the last 24 to 36 months is a shift from that. It still exists, but the predominant scheme now is a financial sextortion. And the primary victim in that is a male. So we've seen this huge shift from females being a more predominant victim in this crime to males. And we've seen this financial piece where once they create an image or once they send an image to this perpetrator, they immediately turn and start asking for money. And if they don't get that amount of money, then they will expose them.
So sextortion is called sextortion because it's sextortion over sexually graphic images that perhaps the person has participated in sending to the perpetrator. So Ashley, talk about the laws surrounding this activity and the consequences for those who indulge in it when they are found out.
Our legislature recently passed that law. It's North Carolina General Statute 14-202.7. And it makes it a violation of the law for a person to threaten to disclose private images, some type of sexual type image, if the person either doesn't do something the person wants them to do or does do something the person wants them to do, and they have to have something of value, whether the offender receives money. A lot of times they want money and more images. And we are seeing it. It makes it a felony. If the victim is a minor, it increases the punishment. So this is true whether you're an adult, you can be a victim. If you're a minor, you can be a victim. The punishment's just going to be more severe if you're a minor.
Talk to me a moment, Ashley, about the moment it happens, about when groomers or potential groomers cross the line. In other words, if a child is conversing with someone who is or who is not who they say they are, but nothing has happened, that's not a crime, one would presume. At what point does the activity become illegal and prosecutable?
When that offender entices or encourages the minor to commit an unlawful sex act and to meet to do so, that's when it crosses the line.
You have to meet?
You have to encourage them to meet with you.
But what if you're enticed into sending a picture, a nude picture of yourself to that person, or a picture in Harrison's case of you harming yourself in some way? That's a crime, right?
It is. If it's just harming, it could be contributing to the delinquency of a minor. If an offender encourages someone who's 15 or younger to send some type of sexually explicit photo of themselves, that's indecent liberties with a minor. We have North Carolina has a number of statutes that will cover that behavior. If you entice a child to meet with you, that's a crime. If you actually show up to meet with a child, that's an enhanced crime. So all of that behavior will be covered under North Carolina law.
So, Kevin, if parents discover this kind of conversation has been going on with their children and these strangers online, no matter the platform, but nothing yet has happened. Nothing illegal yet has happened, but it's very concerning and likely that if it were to continue, something might happen. When they turn to law enforcement, would law enforcement investigate this? Or in the absence of sextortion or some other illegal activity that Ashley has just talked about, would they just have to table it because no crime has yet been committed?
Certainly, I think anytime a report comes in, it is investigated. So the investigation piece is part of it. Now, whether or not it can be prosecuted will depend on exactly your question. Has a crime occurred? If a crime has not occurred, then certainly it cannot be prosecuted. But I think we would have to investigate to determine whether a crime has or has not occurred. So it can and certainly should be and will be investigated. Whether there's a crime or not, to determine that fact of whether a crime has been committed or not.
So when you investigate, I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, you would take the digital devices that these conversations have been held on, and you would do a deep dive into those devices. Would you go so far as to track down the person on the other end of that conversation? Would you go so far as to having law enforcement have a conversation with that person? Where would it end if no crime had been committed?
I think it's just like any other investigation. As we start that investigation and see where it's going, it will depend on where it ends. We can't predict the end of an investigation until we start investigating. But certainly, it could involve looking at that device. It could involve looking at the account. Certainly, if there's communication, there's chats, there's instant messages, all of that would be reviewed. We do need to know who's on the other end of this conversation. So that piece of the investigation would happen to determine who is this person actually conversing with.
But there are some obstacles to that, too. I don't know much about this until I read it yesterday, but evidently Snapchat has what is called disappearing content. Once you read it, it's gone. You can't read it again. Does that make that content disappear to forensic investigators, or is it still there lurking somewhere in the metadata?
I will say that's one of the most disturbing things about Snapchat. That's what they're most known for, it seems, since the company came into existence, is the auto-deleting of messages. What I will tell you as a forensic examiner and from a forensic standpoint is that things that you do on a computer, and phones are generally just small computers, generally speaking, there's evidence of that there, as well as within the accounts. Regardless of what Snapchat may tell us about what they delete or don't delete, I will tell you, as you mentioned earlier, We get tons and tons and tons of reports from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children related to Snapchat reports. And by law, anytime they file a report, they are holding that evidence for a year. So many times that evidence may still be available to us, whether it is forensically on that device or whether it is through the platform itself serving legal process to get that evidence.
So you have the Snapchat feature, Ashley, that we just talked about, but then there's also this thing called end-to-end encryption. And a lot of people have are using apps that encrypt things in both directions. There's a messaging app called Signal, which allows for that. It's used to describe blocking or preventing a third-party recipient, someone who for whom the message was not intended, from viewing, reading, or becoming aware of the information that the content was involved in. This is largely viewed by many as a security bonus because it's protecting your communications back and forth. I would think it's being adopted by more platforms and by users on both sides of the conversation. But there is a downside, it seems to me, because it prevents you from detecting criminal activity. How often do you run across this? What's your advice to parents or to anyone, for that matter, who uses electronic devices and these apps?
I think, once again, there's no substitute for good supervision of your children. We kind of joke, but when I talk to parents, you have no Fourth Amendment rights in your home. If you're paying for that phone, you don't have to get a warrant to go and look at that phone. And that is really what we need to do. We need to be monitoring our kids. And it doesn't require high-tech solutions. I was speaking to one mother. She's a single mom, and she says, you know what I do? I turn off the router at 9 p.m. None of us get to the internet. And that's just what I do to protect my kids.
But if it's a phone, you can get to the internet on the 5G, 4G wireless.
A lot of families have Wi-Fi only phones. Uh-huh. And so they're limited to their Wi-Fi. You do what you can. Some parents have, and we certainly encourage, a social media contract with their kids. And there are rules. Number one, you only download apps we approve of. Number two, you have to lock down your devices to just those friends that we approve of. And if I go on your phone and do a spot check and it's not as we agree, that phone's taken. I did want to comment. You were asking about, because I'm thinking about Harrison's case. What if a parent says, you know what, I've run into a conversation my child's having with a stranger. It's getting suspicious, but we're not at that level. Our local law enforcement has been successful that they have taken over as the victim and looked to see if this conversation would go any further. And under North Carolina law, if you entice who you think is a child, you're still guilty of the crime. And so we have a number of cases. Yeah.
Is there a reverse to that? I mean, can the perpetrator, if caught doing that, be accuse you of entrapment?
They certainly can. And that's why you look at those conversations, and our law enforcement is trained not to lead, not to be the ones to suggest the information. And unfortunately, when you look at these chats, there are offenders you don't need to lead. They are so ready to meet with these kids or who they think are children. They're going to start the conversations. They start the words.
I'm sorry.
Finish. I just say one of our last ops. These offenders were showing up to meet the children. Some had drugs with them. Some had condoms with them. Some had flowers with them. And they all thought that they were going to be meeting with a 15-year-old kid.
Yeah.
Sounds
like Dateline.
That's right.
Very much like Dateline. Kevin, artificial intelligence, we only have a minute left. We haven't really had time to talk about this, but artificial intelligence allows people to create very realistic personas that are not who they say they are. What role, if any, is that playing right now in child grooming?
It definitely is playing a role, and AI is advancing at such a rapid pace that what happened 12 months ago doesn't necessarily mean the same thing that's happening today. We have to be aware that people can create these images without our child ever taking a picture of themselves and sending it. A perpetrator could create this image using AI and still try to victimize this child. More important than ever that we know
that child has particularly if that child has a social media presence elsewhere that the perpetrator can get to and pull photographs from, it seems.
Or that parent, that proud parent posting pictures of their kids.
You are part of a big unit of nationwide, 200 law enforcement agencies across the state, 61 across the nation. Very quickly, I have 10 seconds. How successful are you at what you do?
We are highly successful at what we do. We're highly skilled at what we do and trained to do it, and are passionate. We do what we do because we're passionate about protecting kids, and that's the best way to do it, is putting bad guys in jail.
Kevin Roughton, Special Agent in Charge at North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation and Head of the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, and Ashley Shanley, District Attorney for Cabarrus County. Thank you both for the hour.
Thanks, Mike.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.